jazz.
Busted.
Let's do this.
All right. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 145. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And I got a little red wine in me, but I think we'll do okay. This is a auspicious occasion. I'm finally podcasting back in the USA.
Woohoo!
So I am sitting in a bathtub filled with Bud Light, and I got chicken wings by my side here, and I'm just kind of relaxing and enjoying the ambiance of being back in the great United States of America. Happy to be here.
As far as I'm concerned, you're not really here in a sense. I mean, like, I've just spent the last month and a half driving to the Deep South and the Midwest, and frankly, as far as I'm concerned, you're not really in civilization unless you're at a Starbucks that has raw sugar, which apparently starts about 1,000 miles west of the Mississippi River. So somewhere around Denver, you start to get proper civilization as far as I'm concerned. I'm back in the great, great Republic of California.
There you go.
True civilization.
I never claimed I was in civilization. I claimed I was back in the United States. I'll try not to splash the bud too much as I get going here. So despite the fact that I finally made it back and there's been a gap between our recording of episodes, I mean, the episodes come out regularly at 2-week intervals, but the last one we recorded about a month ago.
Yeah, it seems like forever.
Anyway, this episode, ironically enough, is going to be about artists from the United Kingdom for the most part. None from the U.S. We've got one outlier, but she's European. One of our listeners sent me an email a while back asking, would we like to cover some more British artists? And I said that'd be a great idea, but I'm profoundly ignorant, as you probably already knew from listening to the podcast. And could you recommend some? And so he gave me a list of names and artists, some of which he was more enthusiastic about than others, but kind of gave me a sense of both some of the people he liked on the scene and then some that were kind of popular with the kids. And way back on 138, we discussed a couple of those UK jazz musicians. We talked about Binker and Moses and Yaz Ahmed.
Courtney Pine falls into this category, too.
Absolutely right. Yeah, he is a earlier generation, but he's another important British jazz musician. And so on this episode, we're going to look at four releases by other people off this recommendation list. The one group, Sons of Kemet, is led by Shabaka Hutchings, and he played bass clarinet on the Yaz Ahmed album we discussed back on 138. So we've heard his work before, but this is a group that he's put together and is leading, along with Sons of Kemet's album Lest We Forget What We Came Here to Do from 2015. We'll be talking about Jason Rebello's album Held from 2016. That's a solo piano work. Zo Rahman's Trio Live album for 2007, and she's another important UK piano player in the jazz realm, and Shatner's Bassoon, their album Disco Erosion from this year. And then as a ringer, I've also thrown in Hedvig Molsted Trio's Black Sabbath Metar. Kind of a ringer. It was just kind of a palate cleanser. We've talked about Hedvig before.
She has a very gratifying name to say.
It is. It's kind of fun.
Hedvig Morstadt. She sounds like, I want to say something stupid. She sounds stern and forbidding. Let's just leave it at that.
Absolutely. She's so Scandinavian. So we talked about Hedvig's album Enfant Terrible back on episode 57. Yeah, that was 2014 release. This is a more recent one. So anyway, is there a place you'd like to begin talking about these fine UK artists?
I don't care. You pick. It's fine with wherever you want to go. I don't care.
Okay, well, let's start from simple to complex in terms of instrumentation anyway, and begin with Jason Rebello's Held from 2016. Now, Jason apparently has released a number of albums under his own name, but he's also worked with a number of other jazz musicians, including Gary Burton, Branford Marsalis, Tommy Smith, Tim Garland, and Peter Gabriel, Phil Collins, and your favorite Sting. So for a while there, he played with Sting.
But that's not terrible. I mean, some good people played with Sting too, so including Branford.
Absolutely, right. So anyway, this is not a name that rang a bell. In fact, none of these names did, which again is why I'm so grateful to our listener for kind of cluing me in. And he's got a great blog. I'll see if I can look that up or not. If I don't, I'll mention it in the outro. But I really appreciated his input on this. So anyway, Jason is a piano player. This was his first solo release, Held, from 2016. Thoughts on this one?
I like several things about this. And then other things were a little problematic. The whole album is very enjoyable as far as I'm concerned. But parts of it stand out for me. Parts of it really appealed to me. So the numbers that I really liked, I thought, were Pearl and Tokyo Dream. And I kind of liked Blackbird, although I'll have something to say about that in a second. I also liked Happy But For How Long. I guess I want to preface what I want to say about Rebello with this. Have you ever been to the airport in Portland, Oregon?
Jeez, I don't know if I have. Maybe once.
It's an unforgettable experience if you've been, because it's the only airport I know of that has carpeted walkways. So you don't have that clackety-clack sound of people walking on linoleum. The whole damn place is carpeted. So it feels like they've piped Xanax through the air system. So it's just got this very mellow Northwest groovy feel. And in between two of the terminals, I've been there three or four times. There is a piano, and there's always someone playing piano there. And it's the most civilized thing in the world to be able to sit down with a cup of coffee or whatever in a nice chair in a carpeted lounge area that's this, very large area, and listen to someone noodling on piano. Apparently they pay this person. Typically, the music played is like the airport itself, soothing and calming. It's one of the most zen airports I've ever been in, right? And I felt like a lot of this album would be perfect fodder for the Portland airport, which is to say pleasant, inducing positive feelings, but not particularly memorable. And that's why I singled out the songs that I did. Apart from Blackbird, everything here is an original composition. And they're fine. Some of them are more interesting than others. The whole thing feels a little piano loungy to me as a whole. Now that's not an attack. I'm not dissing this. I'm just saying it has a certain kind of warm, soothing feel overall. The numbers that stood out to me were ones that kind of punched their way through the overall atmosphere of good feeling, as it were, right? So I like Pearl, the opener, just a whole bunch. I think it's a terrific song. It starts out with this kind of, would that be an ostinato or some sort of repeated figure in the left hand? And then a lovely little melody with the right. And it has this kind of nice resolution. I love the song. I think it's every time it comes on, it's an earworm for me. I can actually hum it. I think it's terrific. I like Tokyo Dream as well. It's very warm. It's got a it resolves into a really nice melody that I like quite a bit. And Happy But For How Long, I wondered, I guess I would like to talk to Jason Rebello and ask him about this, because I thought when I listened to it, I thought I was hearing something that was like a first cousin to Jean Sibelius's Valse Triste. False Trees is a short piece which was originally done for kind of, opera or ballet or whatever. And it's about a young man at his mother's deathbed, And as he falls asleep, she kind of wakes up and she hears the sound of this waltz and she gets out of her bed. And suddenly there are these ghostly figures from her past and she's transported back to when she's young and she dances. And it's very brief piece, only like 6 minutes long. She dances. And then at the very end, death comes to the door and she dies. Wow. Typical Swedish happiness. And I thought Happy But For How Long was sort of like a jazz version of this. I don't know if that's just me reading into it or whatever, but it has this kind of moody start, which leads to a kind of peppy tune, which then leads to a kind of very brief, melancholy outro. And I just wondered, I know he came to Wayne Shorter's attention, and Wayne Shorter is very interested in this particular piece, so I don't know, maybe it's just me. I like the number. Of all the melancholy, sweet numbers here, that one kind of stood out for me. I guess I wanted to say something about Blackbird, because the problem with doing Blackbird on solo piano is you have to cope with the influence of Brad Meldow. It is a touchstone piece for Meldow, and Meldow comes to it again and again as a solo and in group settings. And so props to Rebello for having the balls to do this, right? Because Meldow was kind of lifted his leg on this song in a big way. And the way he does it initially sounds Meldow-esque. He has some figures that sound like Meldow. I think the difference is he doesn't pull the tune apart quite like Taffy the way Meldow does. Meldow is ruthless with pop songs. Like he'll give them the treatment and then he will start interpolating whatever Bach fugue he listened to that morning into the melody. You know, I mean, that's what he does. And I would say that Jason Rebello has a little bit more funk in his butt. Well, probably everyone has a little bit more funk in their butt, but he has a little bit more funk in his butt than Brad Meldow. So the treatment initially, when I heard it, when I first got this and listened to it, I was like, oh no, you shouldn't do this, right? I was like, this is not good. You're poking the lion. But then it turned out he kind of took it in a slightly different direction, and it's a little funkier, slightly. There are echoes of the Meldow approach, especially in the opening, but then he has a more funky feel for it, and I kind of like that. I kind of wish that he would have pulled the funk out a little bit more. And don't get me wrong. It's not like anyone's going to assume that this is Grandmaster Flash when they hear his version of Blackbird, okay? I'm just saying it's a little funky. A little
funkier funky than Brad Meldow, right?
Yes. And I wish he would have gotten a little funky a few other times just to give a little more change of pace to this. But on the whole, this was perfectly nice, and sometimes it was quite good. Especially, like I said, Pearl for me is an earworm. I can't get it out of my head. I love that tune to death. I think it's a great song. So that's my take on this album. What did you think about it?
Yeah, I would agree that for me, that makes no sense. but that's where I'm at right now. I think this was the easiest album to digest and to just listen to. It was the most least demanding. That doesn't mean it had the least content or there was no good musical ideas in it. Just that, you know, it's a solo piano recital. He's not Cecil Taylor. It's pleasant. It's melodic. And the nature of what he's doing means that it's not going to kind of intrude on you or shock you. And I liked it pretty well. I wondered if it'd be a red flag for you, because for me, that opening number immediately raised the specter of Mr. Meldow.
It does. The left hand. It's the left hand. Yeah.
Well, it's a sense that Meldow, and it's something I don't always like about his playing, has this obsession with filling the sound field, especially as a solo pianist, that he never lets there be a space. It's always something kind of rumbling beneath, and then he builds on that framework, but it's never like he can imply the harmony and just be more minimalist. It's just not the way he does things. And right, that reminded me that I like it. I think it's a good piece. I agree with you. And then, yeah, when he goes into Blackbird,
thank you.
like, holy crap, dude, you know, are you trying to have some kind of showdown here?
Are you crazy?
Yeah, you know, it was, yeah.
I mean, Ravello was good, but I, you know, I'm not sure there are many people who have the technique to play with Brad. Sort of thing.
Yeah, you might want to do Cry, Honey, Cry, or just, you know, just anything. Dear Prudence, I don't know. I mean, there's
sexy taking something.
Yeah, there's so many, you know, that's one thing I've talked about before, and I'll talk about again. I may eventually put in print this idea that really it's amazing how conservative so many jazz musicians are with repertoire. It's like you have to kind of just pound and pound and pound to get a new song in the playlist of the average jazzbo. It gets very ossified. And so if you break through, you know, okay, Nick Drake's okay, but really what you're saying is Riverman's okay and maybe one other. And it doesn't mean that, you know, most musicians have a couple outstanding songs, not really applicable to the Beatles, but it's this weird sense that to can earn a place, you know, there has to be the innovator who's willing to do it before anyone else has done it. And then even after that, there's this real tentativeness. It's like, is it safe? Is it safe to play Blackbird? Should I try it? And it's like, dude, really pretty much any late Beatles tune could fit under this treatment, or at least, you know, a good half of them. Why does it have to be Blackbird? But, you know, again, I agree with you. It's a distinctive take. It's good. He's got great technique.
It's daring at first, because at first, there, especially in the opening, I'm like, oh, shit. And then he takes it to a slightly different place. And I'm like, I breathed a sigh of relief. I was like, okay, good. You know, that's a smart move.
Right. You know, temperamentally, as you say, he's not quite as brutally analytical. He's not quite
ruthless. Yeah. Right. He's pleasant. When you listen to Meltdown, it's everyone knows I love Brad Meltdown, but you know, listening about that was a little bit of a chore. You gotta like strap on your big boy pants and your big boy ears and settle in and deal with some storm and jog and heavy thoughts, you know. And Ravello is like who I would put on for a dinner party. Everyone would like this.
Oh yeah,
everyone would enjoy this. This would be pleasant for everyone. You wouldn't find yourself pondering in the middle of the, you know, having to like, wait, what was that? What's he doing now? There's none of that. It's pleasant. It's enjoyable. And like I said, there's a couple of earworms here too. So it's not just that. There's some things that will burrow into your brain if you're not careful.
Well, we'll say in Red's defense, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to listen to Seymour Reed's The Constitution yet, his latest with the trio, but he decides to cover a second Beach Boy song. And he picks Friends, of all things. So yes, Brad Meltdown has now recorded a waltz about You Helped Me When Dad Wanted to Cut Off My Hair. Anyway, one of the lighter songs in the Beach Boys canon. So who knows, maybe Brad's lightening up in his old age, you can say.
And does he have children? Children usually help. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't know. Friends, let's be friends. I'll play a little clip from that to torture everyone. A song I'm very fond of, but few other people are. So yeah, in general, I'd recommend it. I like it. I've not heard his other stuff right now. I was looking around on Spotify. He is not represented there, despite the fact he's got a pretty deep back catalog. I don't know that much about the guy. I think it's, again, the sense of these spheres where if you're in the States, there's these fine artists in Europe that you just don't hear about much and don't get much coverage. And I guess part of it's just the sense that, yeah, if you're a United States jazz outlet, that you're going to cover the home team first. I mean, God knows there's thousands of jazz musicians and limited places to cover them. But yeah, he's not a name I knew, and I thought it was a really solid record. I can't decide whether his accessibility and friendliness means that I don't know whether finally there's enough of a hook to keep me coming back. It's hard to say. I don't know whether.
Well, I'd like to hear him in a group setting. I think it would be nice to hear him, you know, hear what he does with other people, hear him interact.
That's right. What would he be like? Or what would he be like live? I don't know. Maybe not with Sting's group, but in his own group. Yeah, maybe.
Hey, stop shitting on Sting's colleagues.
I love to. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, there's a picture of
him. Shit on Sting. Don't shit on his pals. Sting's pals. You're tarring them with the brush of Sting. That's not fair.
God, I'm sure he could rhyme that. And it would be a rhyme that included the whole brush of Sting.
Right, yeah. Brush of Sting. You know, flesh of ring. I don't know.
You find a multisyllabic rhyme for that, and we'd all wince. So anyway, fun, accessible record, and in some ways the easiest listen of the stuff we're talking about tonight. If we're ready to move on, I guess the next group in terms of limited personnel and directness would be Sons of Kemet. was one I was a little bit torn on because they've got a more or less brand new album out on Impulse called Your Queen is a Reptile. And that's referring to the theme or the theory among some people in Great Britain that the royal family of Windsor is really a bunch of space aliens. I don't know if that's true or not. Who can say? I mean, you look at Prince Charles, you do wonder. And that celebrates a bunch of black heroines from his culture. This is slightly earlier. The album from 2015. Lest we forget what we came here to do. And it's an unusual group where he plays tenor and bass clarinet. I prefer to hear a little bit more bass clarinet from him, but that's as may be. He's got a tuba player with him, Theon Cross, and then two drummers, in this case, Seb Rochford and Tom Skinner. So it is a saxophone, tuba, double drum ensemble. And obviously, with a certain kind of political orientation, though, it's much more explicit on Your Queen is a Reptile, where there's a lot of rapping and lyrics, whereas here this is just music. So this is a very weird group, and I'm not sure what I think about them as a studio ensemble. What do you think of Lest We Forget What We Came Here to Do?
Well, Sons of Kemet had me at tuba. as soon as you have a tuba, not that anyone cares what I think about various forms of music, but you know, if you were a listener and you were thinking, I want to start a jazz band and I want Mike the Bastard to like me, start with a tuba. That is the place to go first.
If you just have a tuba, I'm down.
I just fucking love tuba. I can't get enough of tuba. I like this quite a bit, actually. I'm gonna argue that Shatner's bassoon suffers from something that these guys kind of avoid. So almost all of these songs are what I would call riff or groove based. That is to say, either the drummers or sometimes the horns will lay down a riff or a groove, which is then repeated, and then the horns essentially solo over that riff or groove, or they take turns soloing over. And that's mostly the template here. Having said that, they managed to avoid all of it sounding quite the same. I think it might have been nice for them to stretch even a little bit more than they did, because some of these things do begin to blend. But I think all of them are what I would call kind of riff or groove-based tunes, with the exception of the closer, Play Mass. Is really almost just a melody. We actually get a melody, like not a solo, but like an actual melody over the tuba and the drums riffing. And it is, I would say, the prettiest song here, if you're into that. I do like this quite a bit. I think my favorite song here is Hour of Judgment, because, and I'm not sure it's because of this, but Hour of Judgment, the drums drop out. So it's just the tuba and the sax.
Yeah, there's a couple like that, yeah.
Yeah, it establishes a lovely riff, and then the tuba continues to play the riff, and Hutchings solos over. And I like Hour of Judgment a hell of a lot. I think it's a great song. But the opener is, I think, a kind of good example of kind of their modus operandi, right? I mean, so that's one where we have the sax opening over drums. And then around, it's a longish song, In Memory of Samir Ahmad, Awad. It's about 8 minutes long. Somewhere just before the 6th minute, the tuba comes in, and we have Liftoff. the song just kills. It's just fucking awesome. I love the sound of the sax and the tuba playing together. I think they're fantastic. Especially like it when we have like a swift little riff that the tuba is playing for kind of a bass figure. That happens on the second number, in the Castle of My Skin. I like that quite a bit as well. And Tiger is almost a feature for the tuba, and the drums there sound a little bit like a marching band to me. What I think was really smart was the fourth number, Mo Weiser, major tempo change. And it's like they were like, okay, let's slow down. Let's do it a little different. And that was a good move. And I think I would have liked even a little bit more of that change of pace or change of tempo, maybe a song with just a long melodious tuba open before we get into something. But that one has a very slow kind of interaction between the tuba and the sax that builds over a very simple drum riff, and then that just builds and builds and builds, and it is really slinky and sinuous. It's a terrific song. I love the hell out of that. So that's a nice little change of pace as well. I just thought when they do that, I like it, because the typical mode, you know, is going to be riffing. You know, it's going to be the two drummers interacting with one another. They're not really keeping time. They're sort of playing off of one another. And they're adding different percussive accents to their basic rhythm that they've established. And then the tuba will often play a kind of riff or line, and then Hutching solos over it. That's your basic format. I like it a lot, especially because I like the tuba so much, and the tuba isn't relegated to mere bass duty. The tuba does get some melody, and the tuba does get some interactive sort of, there's some lines that he plays with Hutchings, which I think is pretty cool. So I like this quite a bit. I would have been happy with a few more changes of pace. Yeah. But overall, I thought this was pretty cool. I like the sound of Hutchings' saxophone quite a bit here. And I think that's where your mileage is going to vary. If you don't like him as a soloist, you're not going to like this band. But I thought he was pretty inventive and consistently interesting. Let's put it that way. So I like this a little bit better than the Jason Ribello album. I thought this was pretty cool.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know that I am convinced by him as a tenor sax player yet.
You like the clarinet stuff better?
Yeah, and I like him in general better on Yazamaz's album. From a jazz point of view. And so this is like, I think, trying to do something a little different. I mean, to me, the mixture of riffing and just repeating an idea versus kind of venturing out on the limb is a little too favoring the riff. And I get the purpose of that. I get the building the familiarity of that. I get the building the excitement through repetition of that. It's just, I'm too old to get into that shit. You know, I'm like, okay, in a club, if I was a different human being and 30 years younger, because I was really an uptight little fucking 20-year-old, and more of a headbanger, this would be awesome. As an album, sometimes it just seems to be pogoing in place. That's not true all the time. They do mix it up some. It is a neat sound. I mean, I like this idea of the drums and the sax and the tuba. I mean, it's kind of a cool ensemble. And they really do, apparently, I've not heard their first album, but apparently that's got more kind of studio trickery. It's more of a dub sound. This, I think, is kind of a pretty unvarnished, dry, in-your-face recording. This is just, you know, they're trying to just kind of capture the event. But this was the one of the four that I wished the most, or thought the most, would benefit from being live. That just their approach, I think, makes more sense live. And I'm kind of surprised that for three releases now, they've always been studio artifacts. Because I'm just not sure this is the music I want to hear from a studio. Whereas like Jason's album makes perfect sense. And I think Shatner's Bassoon, I read a comment online. Well, you know, you don't listen to avant-garde recordings. You only go to hear them live. It's like, no. This is very much an album. I mean, the Shatner's Bassoon we'll get to in a little bit. No question to me, that's a recording. It's supposed to be. That's the way it works. This, I kind of think it might have been better in front of a crowd. It's not like they're doing anything so complicated you couldn't pull it off live. So I liked it fairly well. I mean, I'm always a little torn about what I'm supposed to be doing. And I think it's more I'm using too much mind and not enough body. Because I think it's more appealing to either your kind of political angst or your butt. rather than necessarily, you know, what are they accomplishing in terms of being soloists or in terms of complex interactions. But the playing's at a high level. I like the tuba player a lot. I think he's sprightly. I think he really keeps the riffs going. I think the drummers are good. And maybe I just haven't been listening to this album loud enough. I mean, I think it might make more sense at a kind of a visceral volume, but the nature of my existence the last 4 weeks has just prevented me from listening to music kind of all by itself. I've been working or traveling, and, you know, it's been kind of crazy. But an interesting group. I'm not sure I've been won over to their side as a listener for pleasure. So anyway, this is my thought. I'm of two minds about the record and the group. I've heard their third album, the latest one on Impulse, a couple times. If you want to go for more of their political statements, that third one, Your Queen is a Reptile, both is even more explicit in its agenda in terms of titles, but then it's also got a couple of numbers with rapping on it. So you can hear the verbal expression of these ideas. But they're clearly an up-and-coming group in Great Britain, and they're clearly a little bit more, I don't know, distinctive or challenging than a Rebellious playing in a well-known tradition. This is a little bit more out.
Yeah, I was going to point out, I also meant to say, and I forgot, the two songs, The Long Night of Octavia Butler, followed by Afrofuturism. I don't know if you noticed this, but I think I noticed this on the last listen through the album. The Long Night of Octavia Butler is just very brisk number with, you know, basically the horns soloing over the drums. Afrofuturism, the follow-up, is, I think, the same song, just faster.
Ah.
Like, well, listen to it. I think it's
pretty much, yeah.
It's almost identical. I mean, I think it's deliberate. I mean, I think, in other words, I have to listen to it one more time. But on this, you know, I listen to these things in order the first time, and then they're jumbled. And then just before the podcast today, I listened to it in order again. I was like, wait, that sounds like the same song, only faster. Which I thought was kind of cool if that's what they did, but I didn't have time to go back and double check right before the podcast. So I don't know, but I thought, and that would be kind of interesting since Octavia Butler is associated with the idea of Afrofuturism, novelist, science fiction novelist.
They're just being environmentally conscious, doing a little recycling. And I think it was the Afrofuturism too, that there's some clip of very quiet kind of background chatter or just a weird little sonic interlude that is very studio artifact. And then they go back to this live dry sound. Yeah, they don't do a lot of stuff in the background, don't do a lot of manipulations. It's mostly kind of the acoustic event approach. But there's a little weird curlicues in the background there. And apparently, as I said, the first effort was more studio bound. And then I don't know that I consider the third one, Your Queen is a Reptile, particularly a studio take. It's just, it's naturally a little different because of the vocals and things. But again, you know, another, like Binker and Moses, kind of a group that's grabbing the ears of the young, broad-minded populace. Well, if you're ready, we'll move on to Zoe Rahman's live album called simply Live.
Surely that's Zoe.
Okay, you're right. It's Zoe. In fact, I thought to myself, you got to say that Zoe, and then I didn't say it Zoe.
I hate to be the asshole who corrects you, but I also don't want Zoe to send us a letter and saying, what the fuck is wrong with you guys?
It's okay. Everybody anyway, corrects me.
Sorry. No.
I think you're right. It's Zoe. In fact, I meant it. Well, you know, if she put the Y on there, unambiguous. Come on. Spring for the extra switch hitting. What is it?
Dude, no one puts a Y on Zoe. There's an umlaut over the E.
I think you'll find that Zoe Deschnall, or however you say her name,
who is
fucking Y,
the model for no one on anything.
Aw. Okay. Well, I'm just saying, that's where I've seen it. Okay.
All right.
She's famous.
Zoe. I hate Zoe.
Ziggy Stardust used one. It wasn't just Zig. Okay. Now we're really wandering off. Anyway, this is a 2007 release. She debuted as a leader in 2001.
Can I ask, is it a 2007 release?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it is. 2007, I believe it was recorded. Now, it may have been, the date may have been
2009. I got you. Okay.
I thought, well, which date do I want to use? And well, I mean, to me.
I was just confused. I wasn't trying to correct you. I just didn't know.
No, that's like, cool. No, absolutely. Because I did. I looked it up and it was like 2009. And then I'm like, well, it's recorded 2007. Just in terms of thinking about her musical trajectory, I wanted to say 2007. But yes, it was released 2009. Absolutely true. And apparently this was at the Pizza Express. I have fond memories of the Pizza Express. It is both a restaurant and a jazz venue in London. She is with Gene Calderazzo on drums.
There you go.
Ollie Hayhurst on bass. And then Idris Rahman appears on clarinet on a few numbers.
Who is her brother. You didn't know that?
You know, I didn't look it up.
Idris is her brother.
Okay.
He's actually into world music and Afro reggae pop stuff, in addition to, you know, Bengali pop, Banglo pop. So yeah, he has his own career. He's got his own groups and stuff, but he's more on the pop vein, which is kind of interesting.
Okay. Well, good for him. His name is, to me, unambiguous as to how to pronounce, so I like him better than his sister. Just kidding. So yeah, Zoe's a piano player. I kind of picked this record. She had a more recent one that was also solo, and I think I like this one better for the energy and because occasionally there's a horn.
Right.
It is a live document, which means the bass player has a credit. But you have to go looking for Ollie sometimes. You got to get your sonic flashlight out to find the poor guy. And the drums, I think the drummer's fine. He's energetic. He's got good things to play. It's not like it's a disaster, but his toms sound a little cardboardy. Not all the way, but just, you know, it's not a perfect recording. So that's just kind of my two cents on the way it sounds. What do you think about the musical content of Live?
I was going to ask you one other question before we got started, which was that since all of these are British, I went and looked at John Fordham. He's the jazz reviewer for The Guardian. And he mentioned that Zoe, one of her influences is Joanne Brachin. And I was like,
you're kidding. Cause I was thinking of Joanne listening to this, just walking around today thinking,
that's what I wanted to ask you. Did you hear any Joanne when you listened to
this? Yeah, you know, that's so funny because I did not run across that particular review. But what I, you know, one thing that struck me about this record is that Zoe, on this record at least, and I've heard another one I was quite liking on Spotify this afternoon, she doesn't seem like a player with a lot of darkness. I don't know if introspection's the right word, but she seems straightforward, joyous, energetic, accessible, likable. And then I was thinking, well, is there anybody who's kind of emotionally in that place that I can think of? And then I thought both in terms of emotion and a little bit in terms of just a couple of her song structures, it suddenly hit me a little bit like, by no means a Denikit, but just some resemblance to Joanne Brachin. So that's funny that this guy made that connection. Because I thought, well, has she ever talked about her? I just didn't have time to find out. So,
well, I think I read the review days ago. I have some vague memory of him using the word mentor. So that made me wonder if she'd ever studied with Joanne. I don't know.
Okay.
There may be no connection. It may just be in that reviewer's mind, but he mentioned it. And after he mentioned it, I couldn't stop thinking it. It's like once you, you know,
sure.
Sometimes you don't think of pink elephants. All you can do is think of pink elephants. Once I read that, like I had not thought that.
Which Brachin made an album about, by the way. So that's the real reason that's happening.
Exactly. I had not explicitly thought of Joanne Brachin until I read that review, and now I can't stop thinking of her. For me, the what I would say is she's a sprightly player. There's kind of bright, bubbly is a little too frivolous sounding, but she's got this kind of effervescent, boppy, sprightly quality. I think it shows up really well on that first number. That's a cover. Who is the song by The Stride? Who is that?
Stop asking me questions. Question time is over. You've got to look it up. I don't know.
It's by, we can edit this out. It's by, I want to say Ahmad Jamal, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Which would be, you know, I don't think she sounds like Ahmad Jamal. She's not so cat and mouse. She's not quite so coy.
Right.
But again, tonally, and this is not a criticism. I mean, I enjoy this record. And as I said, the solo was not doing much for me, but then I ran across another album from kind of the mid-career, and I quite liked it. So, you know, this is a player that I'm pretty enthusiastic about. And of course, I'm a big partisan, I think you are too, of Joanne Brachin.
Yes.
Not the only piano player I want in my life. There are certain things she doesn't do well, and there's certain times you don't want to be in that emotion space that she creates. But man, you know, overlooked and I think really distinctive and delightful. And yeah, Zoe, that's interesting that she's more or less explicitly, you know, in my defense, it's just been fucking insane the last few weeks. But two, some of these musicians, you know, start going looking around, poking around the web, trying to get background. It's not thick on the ground. There isn't a ton of stuff out here. It's weird again that almost even on the World Wide Web, European musicians, you know, their presence is muted often. There's just not a lot of coverage, not a lot of reviews, not a lot of exposure for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, fine player. I think this is a fine album, but it was a little hard to find out much about, or you did a better job than I did.
And so The Stride is an Abdullah Ibrahim or Dollar Brand.
Dollar Brand tune. Okay.
Yeah, Dollar Brand tune. And very likable. I would echo everything you said about the bass being completely unhearable here.
God,
it's really frustrating.
Well, he solos once and you can hear him, but I mean, in the ensemble, good luck.
I mean, it's just her and the drummer. Like that opener tells you everything you need to know about the recording because she and the drummer have a great rapport, I think. But yeah, it's like a two-person show. You just can't hear the bass on this recording, and I find that really frustrating. Yeah, I find her a very sprightly, engaging, bright in the sense of, like, not intelligence. I mean, of course she's intelligent. I mean, there's a sort of brightness to the playing here that I really like. I thought that the clarinet playing was interesting on Ha Gente Aquí, which I think means the people are here or something. He sounds like he's in a klezmer band almost. His clarinet sounds very...
Right, yeah.
I mean, I like it, but I was like, this was not what I was expecting. I was expecting something much more world music-y based on what I had heard about him. I thought, okay, so this is... We're gonna get out there. And no, it was this very peppy kind of... I thought klezmer as soon as I heard it. It was kind of fascinating. Now, the second number he plays on, it's a much slower number. I'm going to assume that's Portuguese or Bengali. I don't know, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce this. The song Muche, Muchejaoa, and then third word, Dingulli. That's a very sort of melodic, contemplative, sinuous tune, and the clarinet only appears sort of halfway through it. That's a pretty nice change of pace, I thought. That's a pretty good song. Doesn't really feature her. It's really his feature on that particular song. But tonally, it might be the darkest thing here. It's the most melancholy sort of thing. Everything else is kind of pepped up. Even Harlem Blues is a bright, sprightly number. So I like her. I like her playing. I did think of Joanne Burkeen a lot once that fucking reviewer put her in my head, which irritates me because I it's frustrating. I'm sure Zoe Rahman doesn't want to go around being someone else, and it will be irritating to hear some putts like me, you know, have this in my head. I think I'd like to hear more of her. I will say that I like her playing. What is it on the piano when they don't use the pedal a lot? It seems like the piano is much sort of more echoey. Or help me with musical terms here, Patrick.
Well, are you saying that the sustain pedal's down, that she's not? Because, I mean, if you put down the sustain pedal, when you hit a string, it's not muted. It just rings. There's a mute pedal, which obviously does the opposite. And another one that I never had enough lessons to figure out what the fuck it did. Yeah. So is she getting a little Jason Adasewicz on you or whatever?
Adashevitz?
Adashevitz,
no, yeah. Well, if she is, I like it. And she does it more on The Stride and Harlem Blues, I think, than on other songs. Piano gets a little echoey, which I like, actually. I don't know. It sounds good. If I was listening to the bass or able to hear him, I might be irritated with it. But since I gave up trying to hear him about two listens in, it doesn't bother me at all. So anyway, I want to listen to her more, and I want to try not to think about Joanne Burkeen, and just I want to hear other recordings by her. I will say that nothing here jumped out at me as none of these became earworms. I don't have the melodies for any of these in my head. I found this pleasant and enjoyable and likable, but nothing stuck. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that on all the other albums we looked at, something did stick. And for this one, there wasn't one song that really jumped out at me that I kind of could hang my hat on. So I feel like, you know, I've given this album 6 or 7 listens. I feel like I need to give even more. And I'd like to hear her in other settings, maybe hear other trio work by her, just to have a better sense of her as a player. But she's definitely someone who I want to hear more of. Everything here is interesting and good, even if I don't find anything particularly memorable. I like everything that I heard on this album. I'm not being very helpful. I'm sorry.
Hey, no, it's good. And I think the album I was getting into was Kindred Spirits from 2011. Quite like that. There's a couple others that you can stream, and I will be listening to more of her. Yeah, it's hard to put your finger on, but there is a kind of, she's maybe not quite as obsessive and focused as Joanne can get. And so then her kind of more or less sunny nature, I don't know what you want to say, it sometimes doesn't get its emotional hooks into you the way some players might. And so, yeah, what do you hang on to? I mean, it's quite good. I don't think
she's not as fucking weird as Joanne Burkeen either. Like,
no, she's not, which is, right. No. And again, if there's somebody in that school, cool, because I think Joanne should have a school. I think, again, she's underrated and just a hell of a lot of fun and definitely worth listening to. So, yeah, I think the other thing is this album is a bit of a, and some of these, you know, we cannot emphasize enough, at least for me, this was like, I was not familiar with the scene. I asked for some names and I dipped the toe in. I'm not somebody who's grown up watching the career of Jason Rebello unfold, listening to every new Zoe Rahman album with eager anticipation. It's like, oh, I've never heard of these people. Let's get a record, spin it, find out what we think, and then decide, do we want to go further? So yeah, neither of us are presenting ourselves as kind of scholars of, experts about this music. It's like, this is the first encounter, I think, for both of us of this stuff. So yeah, I want to learn more about her. I think this album suffers a bit from being live in that it's just not that brilliantly recorded. And, you know, the Pizza Express is not exactly the most spacious venue. I'm sure the acoustics are not the most forgiving. And the energy, I think, is good. I mean, I think that, you know, it's not a bad performance. It's just not the best capturing of the performance. And yeah, I don't know whether there's something about her that will really get its hooks in or not. But it's a likable record. And I do want to listen to more of her stuff. So, you know, again, if there's somebody at the school of Joanne, I want to give that person a chance. But yeah, it's so funny because I had not made that connection until today when I finally had time to, like, get this in the headphones and focus on it as I was going to and from work. It's like, that's who that reminds me of. Anyway, I think this guy's a genius because he agrees with my independent. Obviously, a brilliant man. But I wish I knew more about her. I wish I could have found out more. I cannot emphasize how much it's been kind of insane the last couple of weeks. So speaking of insane, here's a group that named itself after a joke from the satirical British show Brass Eye.
Which, can we just talk for 10 minutes about Brass Eye? Because there's a handful of people who will know what we're talking about, and then a whole bunch of listeners who will, they won't know. Brass Eye is a satirical... It is true satire. It was a television program. They only did a handful of shows.
Like six, and there was a seventh that was a band.
The seventh is the best. They did six or seven shows in England on various topics. It's the brainchild of Chris Morris, who's associated with a whole bunch of other shows. The Mighty Boosh, the IT Crowd, he's associated with a whole bunch of shows. And a whole bunch of actors and characters from that. Noel Fielding. Matt, what's the guy? What's Matt's last name?
Benning, Baring, something.
Barry. Everything he says sounds like this. Matt Barry and the Richard Iowati. All these characters are sort of people who have been on Chris Morris' show.
Slightly older, right? He's kind of the sharp end of the wedge of that group.
Exactly. He's the leader of the pack or whatever. And somehow... he was allowed to make these shows. And the best one is a show called Pedageddon, which is the most brilliant thing, one of the most brilliant things I've ever seen.
Well, and just to clarify what it is, it's a parody of a news magazine show.
Dedicated to dealing with pedophilia. And they're having an event. The premise of the show is they're having an event in England in Wembley Stadium called Pedageddon, where they're going to put an end to pedophilia. And Wembley Stadium's going to be a safe space for children or something, right? So it's like, where will the pedophiles go? To Wembley Stadium, where there are millions of children.
Of course, yeah, right. It's always a... But yeah, the thing was, is this was before The Daily Show. And so he would get British, and I use the word in quotation marks, celebrities or politicians, completely oblivious to his intentions, to go on there and plead for the poor elephant that stuck its trunk up its own butt to be aided, or to warn kids about the dangers of cake, which is represented on the show about drugs, is the size of a fucking pizza and 3 inches, like a pill the size of a pizza.
And they actually got Phil Collins. They got him. Like, Phil Collins was one of the people they got to go on camera and, intone against the dangers of cake and other famous people.
And so the claim is that cake affected the area of the brain known as Shatner's bassoon.
Which is another joke, right? Yeah.
Which affects one's ability to understand time. And so someone was killed by a bus trying to cross the street. He thought he had a month to get across. it's ridiculous stuff.
And Shatner's bassoon refers to an episode of Star Trek where they had a wind quintet on the fucking bridge of the Enterprise, and Captain Kirk played bassoon.
Oh my God! Okay,
you didn't know this?
I was scared by Star Trek as a child. I never saw
it. Just the words Shatner's bassoon sound dirty.
But yeah, right. But yeah, long. So anyway, and he would get people saying the best one that my son really enjoyed as a physicist was one talking about the dangers of heavy electricity, where particle accelerators would flatten electrons, causing them to fall out of the electrical cables and kill people. It was like invisible lead soup. And he had people saying the phrase invisible lead soup quite seriously as a warning against the dangers of heavy electricity.
Chris Morris actually got someone in Parliament to ask a question of the Prime Minister at question time about what is the government doing about this new drug on the streets, Cake.
Yes, I know. Yeah, anyway, so
brilliant. Yes,
so, a funny show.
This band is named for Brass Eyes' idiotic joke.
Very, very British, right? They are wearing their pride of being from the UK on their sleeve.
Yes.
And it is by far the most out ensemble. It's a quintet. This is the album that is by far the most produced and cut together and challenging. It's probably my favorite of them, and I enjoyed them all. So it's Johnny Richard keyboards, Michael Barden bass, Craig Scott on guitar, Oliver Dover on alto and baritone saxes and clarinet, and he does like the berry, and Joost Hendrik on drums. And they add this explicitly, and cowbell.
Yeah, I saw that.
So anyway, wow. I listened to an earlier record by them, and it was pretty noisy and shaggy. This one is noisy at times, but by no means shaggy. I mean, to me, it seems like a very carefully thought out, very deeply structured work. I loved it to death. What do you think of Disco Erosion from 2000?
I don't love it as much as you. I will say my first impression, and then that has been reinforced on subsequent listens, is this is a little mathy. This is close to math rock. Very precise, very taut, very, you know, what is the time signature on Derpa Days? 1711? You know what I mean? Fuck, I don't know what the hell they're playing. But it's not mathy in the way that, say, Battles is a math band, right? It doesn't have that prog precision, Robert Fripp in a corner, sticking needles in the engineer's ass for not getting something right. It doesn't have that. They're quirkier than that. So it's mathy, but it's quirky, I think. I thought this could have used a little more change of pace, frankly. I like this, but I don't like it as much as you do. It felt to me a little formulaic at times. There are only four cuts here. There are two longer ones, about 13 or 12 minutes, and two shorter ones that are about 8 minutes. So it doesn't overstay its welcome. Yay. But I guess I like the moments where they change things up. You've Got to Play the Game is kind of emblematic for me, right? You've Got to Play the Game starts out with some kind of spacey keyboard washes. Punctuated by angular interventions, by alto, guitar, and drums. And then that's kind of how it starts. And it goes on that way till about the seventh minute, where it gets really open and spacey at that point. It kind of, it's like one movement ends and we have a second movement start, which is kind of open and spacey. But then it starts building around the ninth minute or so. And then by minute 10, it's almost this ponderous, heavy rock feel with all five players kind of going at it. And then at about the 12th minute, it goes back to this quirky, spacey minimalism, and that's your outro. And that's kind of the formula on a lot of these songs, it feels like to me. We get lots of these sort of quirky horns over keyboard and percussion washes, and then things will shift into kind of a spacey moment sometimes where Dover will solo over the spacier moments, and then it'll get busy again. Derpa Days has a kind of fragmented stop-start feel to it that reminds me a lot of John Zorn's short pieces, but this is a long-form version of that. So you know, it reminds me of something like Snagglepuss, which is only like 25 seconds long. But this goes on a lot longer than that. This is one of those 8-minute numbers, I think. But to me, it felt like all four numbers were kind of like this. And I don't have a sense of being able to tell these apart, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just that they felt samey to me. Zappa has a much more busy math rock start than the other songs. But then at the third minute or so, we get this kind of spacey break, like we got on the other songs where the keyboards kind of do their thing for a while. And then it starts to build again over guitar washes at around the sixth minute, right? So this felt a tiny bit formulaic to me, and I wanted them to change it up a little bit more than they were doing. Darts, the final number, has a kind of angular, noodly, spacey start, which resolves around the third minute or so when the drums kick in, and then the sax starts to solo at the fourth minute, and then at the fifth minute it goes back to kind of spacey, angular keyboards. This is probably the most out number. The guitar and the drums and the sax get pretty frenetic as they exit here. Frankly, I would have liked more out. You were describing one of their earlier releases as shaggier, and I guess I would have liked a little more shaggy. This felt maybe a little too pre-planned in some ways. I liked it, and I definitely want to hear more stuff by them, just by virtue of the name alone. But the playing here is very good. It just felt a little formulaic to me. But you liked it a whole lot better than that.
Yeah, I did. I think that for me, I think we want to emphasize that within a song, there's a lot of shifts. I mean, you're looking at a macro level, which maybe I hadn't thought about in terms of, are these changes of pace pattern in a way that's consistent. But for me, the change, I guess, flowed in a way that I found pleasing. It was never seemed quite stuck in one rut too long. And it is, one nice thing about all these records is that these are artists who seem to have recognized that the natural length of a release is somewhere between 35 and maybe 52 minutes. None of them just go on and on and on, which is, I think, generally a really good idea. There are exceptions, but for the most part, if you're going to release a record, it should not run 60 minutes.
Well, or if it does, it better hold my interest.
It should be something, you know, that should begin with Exile and then with Street, something like that. Yeah, there's just very few records that can pull that off. So I like that. I think that maybe having heard the more noise-oriented, just kind of energy-focused music of the first release, and I only heard this glancingly. I did not sit down and listen to that record repeatedly. I was really pleased by the fact that this felt a lot more focused. I mean, I say for sure this is a studio artifact. This is a record that's supposed to be a record. I wouldn't think that listening to them live would be quite the same thing. They might be able to do it live, if so, I'm very impressed, because God, it is complex. I mean, the compound meters and everything. Maybe what leavened it for me is the humor. I mean, there's both energy and humor here. It doesn't take itself super seriously, even though it is in certain ways kind of uptight and mathy, the way you might think of like Frank Zappa or something. But I don't know, it seemed a little bit more genial than Frank. You often seemed cynical, detached, bitter, whatever you want to say. Thinking emotionally, the tone reminded me a little bit, not the technique, not the sound, not the structural approach, but just kind of the tone reminded me a bit of J.A. Grinelli and Mr. Lucky. We've talked about their work before. L-O-L-A, they're obviously Lola, where they were doing more covers, and it's maybe a little bit more to the rock spectrum, but you know, they strike me as having that same mix of humor and energy and that same kind of blend of rock and jazz moves. But I thought this was really successful. I liked it a lot. I did not feel like it got particularly in a rut. And there's a lot of very impressive playing going on. That said, yeah, this is definitely not, you're not going to hear a groovy blues. You're not going to hear the Bearing of Souls. This is very cerebral music. It's there is a lot of energy. And I guess there's humor, but there's not a lot of heart on sleeve emoting for sure. And some of it's fairly abrasive. I mean, it's not like Brotsman or something. It's more about, I guess, the contrasts. Blasts and then quiet and, you know. But anyway, I found it interesting. And I definitely would like to hear what they do next. They clearly seem to have decided they wanted to have a more structured approach than they had before. And so maybe they went too far that direction. I don't know. And again, as a record, it did seem to go on a journey and have a story to tell in 40 minutes, which can be kind of unusual for jazz records, many of which are great, but just don't, you know, there's not a sense of you're going from point A to point B necessarily. It's not a real linear thing. You could scramble the tracks. It wouldn't matter. And I think you could probably do that on Zoe or Jason's album. And you could find a number of mixes. But here, I guess, really, it's not just the order of songs. But the songs, you know, themselves are a sequence of events. They aren't kind of a groove. So I liked it pretty well. But yeah, it's kind of range, you know, where do you fall on the spectrum between Sons of Kemet, which is about directness and riffs and, you know, that kind of, I don't know, populist energy versus this, which is about snark and complexity and maybe absurdity. You know, that might give you the whole spectrum in a sense of musical approach and emotional temperature right there between the two of them. Any other thoughts on our friends Shatner's bassoon?
No.
Okay. The bassoon must be put back in its case, the double reed carefully put away for another evening. Well, anyway, do you have any pop? Oh, I'm sorry. I almost forgot Hedvig. Never forget.
Hedvig.
So I kind of, this is almost an EP. It's like 35 minutes long, 4-track album, as well as the Shatner's Bassoon. We listened to one of her albums earlier, as I mentioned. This is more recent. What do you think of Black Sabbath?
Well, I have not studied it for the show, but I have listened to it, and I wish I got it in my earphones right now. On the first listen, I loved it. I mean, this hits all my reptile pleasure zones. I love the shit out of this album. This is a trio, and they are this is when you turn up to 11. It's just Hedvig shredding with a bass and drummer, and they make a fuck ton of noise, and she's an awesome guitarist. I love this. This is just heavy metal, shredding, headbanging. It's like Sonny Chirac on acid. It's awesome. I think it's fantastic. I don't know. I mean, I hope you like it, because this just appeals to me enormously. I really like this album a lot. And sometimes on my trips when I'm driving, I have two playlists, reading and not reading. And because officially Hedvig is on the reading list, she's a nice change of pace, you know, because there I will be sitting in a coffee shop or sometimes driving, you know, and I'll have heard Something Sweet by Frank Strozier. And then this comes on and I want to drive my car off a bridge. It's fucking awesome. I really like this. If you like heavy metal, if you like shredding, get you some Hedvig Malmsteen immediately. I think she's awesome, and I love this album.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm quite as enthusiastic. I wish the songs were a little shorter, but yeah, it's a great sonic world to be in.
That is not the right answer. These are not supposed to be shorter.
Okay, I'm wrong.
How are you going to shorten In the Court of the Trolls? Seriously.
Maybe, I don't know, make it the Hallway of the Trolls?
The Court of the Trolls takes 8.5 minutes to get through it, not a second less, you wimp.
There you go. But yeah, it's a fun group. It is largely a metal band. It's all instrumental. So there aren't any lyrics about the Court of the Troll, which is
That's
probably
right. No,
for the best.
no pesky words getting in the way of the. And she lives on the sustain pedal. I mean, holy shit. Echo, 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 echo.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Yeah. It's distorted. It's sustained. It's about texture. The rhythms are not particularly sprightly.
Nope.
They're not quite Black Sabbath style, but there's some plod. But yeah, a lot of fun. And I don't know, the thinking person's heavy metal or something. You know, she's just a little off the beaten track, a little more challenging, maybe a little bit more toe, if not a foot, in the jazz camp. So it was fun. I enjoyed it. But I think the one we did earlier, I liked a little better, maybe. But, you know, Mike just wanted to choose between his babies. He loves all his heavy metal babies equally.
Well, I'm trying to figure out the title, right? I mean, because it's supposed to, I guess, be an oblique reference to Black Sabbath, right? Stabat Mater is a...
Well, Stabat. I forgot the T, but yeah, I'm assuming, yeah, you know, and of course she's a heavy metal chick, so she's spooky, she's a scary mama, I don't know. It's another 70s Italian horror film title to me, I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, Hedwig, you know, it irritates me. I'm on like a music trading site and someone posted best female guitarists. And I looked at the list and I was so irritated with people because they said all the usual idiotic suspects. And so I threw in Mary Halverson and Hedwig Malmsteen and no one knew who they were. I'm like,
oh, fucking idiots.
How can you not know who these two amazing female guitarists are? You guys are. And you call yourself music aficionados, you fucking morons. You know, so
he's well loved on this group.
Someone mentioned one of the lead guitars from Heart. I'm like, really? Really? Come on. Turn in your musician appreciation card now. Go back to zero. Start over.
It's tough to meet Mike's standards. Well, speaking of music appreciation, any jazz or any pop on your mind you'd like to talk about?
Because I've been traveling, it's all been old stuff that has been, you know, I bring music with me and I cycle old stuff out and put new stuff in. So there won't be anything that I would talk about that is new in the sense of I have never heard it before. But in recent rotation, I've mentioned them before and I'll mention them again. Elbows, the takeoff and landing of everything. Love this band. Think they're awesome. This is probably their best album. I don't know how to put it. They're sort of a indie rock band that has a Peter Gabriel sounding vocalist, but that, in a good way, not in a bad way. And they just have some cool vocals and some cool. They sometimes get anthemy, but not always, not often enough. They have a lot of quieter numbers. The best song on the album is something called "My Sad Captains," which is a look back at one's drinking buddies who are now long gone, and it has a great line in it about he's thinking about when they were young and they would ride their bicycles around, and he called it the BMX apothecary. Because they would ride their bikes around town and get high. It's a great way to refer to your running mates, I think. So anyway, I like this band a lot. I've talked about them before, and I'll shut up now.
That's okay. Yeah, it's a running endorsement of Elbow here, so listeners, you got to look them up. I have not listened to new pop. I did get to go to a couple concerts. So back in the States, I first got to see Kenny Garrett at the Jazz Kitchen.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, that was a weird experience. We were not able to get into the first show. It was sold out. And they said it was like sitting at the bar. And there's somebody like, you'll see him on the TV. I'm like, well, okay, is this just the bar that's behind the dining room? That's literally attached to it? That's, you know, open to it? Just that it's a little further back? Because I would have been happy to go there. In fact, sometimes I actually prefer sitting back there because the bass energy gets out of hand in that particular space. But anyway, so we saw him at 10 at night. He had a quintet, percussionist, drummer, piano player, though the poor guy, half the time you couldn't hear him, and a bassist. And he is in a really intense Coltrane phase at the moment. So listeners, if you're going to go out and catch Kenny, just be ready for that. If you're into that kind of relentless energy where he's kind of daring the listener to wear out first, and I'm going to tell you what, Kenny won every time. I'm like, okay, whoa, dude, you win. You know, there's one point where he just kind of soloed by himself for like 5 minutes, and it was impressive. I mean, Kenny's a fine player. I was glad to finally get to see the guy live. You know, looking at him like, yeah, you look older than your record covers. Oh, from the fucking 80s. Yeah, no wonder. We're both older, aren't we? Shit. But, you know, he was in good shape. He was playing well. It's just that it was this kind of obsessive, modal music that was very loud. The drummer, at times, I just felt like he was going to break the skin. And I was, you know, 20 feet from him, not far enough. The piano player was just lost. And as sometimes happens in that room, the mid-bass energy just kind of muddled the fuck up of what was going on in the middle of the ensemble sonically. And then you're kind of left with, well, this lives or dies on its interaction, because harmonically, that's one fucking chord or maybe two. So you need to hear the way the musicians are responding to one another in this kind of almost religious fervor of playing. And if you can't hear what they're doing, the nuances of it, it just seems kind of thuddingly repetitious at times. So anyway, yeah, he's in fine fettle, but right now where he's going, I don't necessarily want to follow him. I'm a little shocked because I always think of him as somebody that's like kind of got populist leanings, always trying to reach the audience. And he did seem he certainly was getting a good response. Most people seemed pleased. The lady at the door didn't seem happy that I left after the first encore. It's like, one, it's an hour drive home. Two, my head hurts. And she could tell, because I'm never very good if I'm at a live event. I don't cover my feelings very well. I don't have a good bland listening face. I'm either a happy boy or a bored boy, or in this case, kind of an ouchy boy, because it's like, it's so loud and it's not happening. I just felt like the whole time he was trying to force some kind of epiphany and didn't quite ever make it. Anyway, Kenny Garrett, always suggest seeing these masters when you can if they're live, but it was kind of wearing on my spirit a bit. He's in an interesting place right now. I had no idea this is where Kenny had gone, but he is into late Coltrane at the moment. So be ready for that. The other guy I got to see, Hilbert Center Theater, I got to see Herbie Hancock. Herbie's 78 years old. Guess what Herbie hasn't gotten rid of?
Parachute pants.
And the guitar. There's a guitar. I thought they'd all been destroyed like in 1995. They're like, there's a bonfire and all the guitars.
He wasn't wearing parachute pants.
They weren't really. They weren't the full parachute, no.
Okay,
but
good.
He had a ensemble there, drum, bass. The bass player apparently had played with or was playing with the Saturday Night Live band. I did not catch the name, didn't recognize it. The drummer was a very energetic gentleman, did a fine job keeping these grooves going. And then the guitar player was Lionel Luaki. I don't know how to. Luki. Anyway.
Lionel Luki.
No, not Lionel. So you see his name and you think, like the train, Lionel. But when they say it, it's like Lionel.
But his last name is Luki. Yeah,
it's very exotic.
I have one album by him. Yeah,
you know, I've got a couple of recordings he's on. He's never really caught fire from me recording. Here he was, had a grand old time in his element. Herbie is like, I had no idea what to expect here. I mean, he's obviously got an incredibly influential, very long-ranging career. He has oscillated between acoustic focus and electric. And this was like 1972 to 1978.
Did he play Rocket?
You know, he didn't, but he played a very hyped version of Cantaloupe Island. And then the encore, which he'd already hinted at in his overture, was Chameleon. And that went on for a good 10 minutes, and he hit some notes on the guitar that made both Joyce and Rand want to hold their ears. It was very, very high and piercing. And at the very end, he did one of those little, you know, rock jumps you do with the guitar where, you know.
Oh, no.
So he didn't, you know, it was impressive as hell for a 78-year-old. He was in good humor. He was funny guy. Yeah.
It's interesting. Cantaloupe, that song is, he's got a couple of songs that are touchstones for him. What's the other one? Watermelon Man, something?
Yeah, the earlier one, Cantaloupe Island, was huge. It was sampled by, I think, like U3.
But those are touchstones for him. Like, he periodically plays those are his compositions. He comes back to them, like, every four or five albums and does them again.
Oh, absolutely.
Like,
right.
Yeah, they're like, if you want to check in on where Herbie is, see what he's doing with those songs. So, no Head Melter? No?
He did Absolute Proof.
Okay.
Yeah, this was very much like the Headhunters. Some right. of it was as spacey as the previous band, the Wilder band on Warner Brothers. And every now and then I got tinges of Miles in the 80s. I think maybe it was a guitar player. It was a little more direct funk, but it was very much, this was about the funky electric Herbie of the 70s. And he would play piano occasionally. One, it was amplified in a way that made it sound like an especially unpleasant synthesizer. You know, it was just, it's amazing how hard it is to make piano sound good amplified. It sounded really metallic, but in the context, that didn't matter. It wasn't like he was playing Debussy or something. But yeah, it's amazing to think that it was like all the way back in the 80s when he was backing Wynton Marsalis, recreating Miles Davis in the 60s. Right. And that was that great reaction against the 70s and electricity. And here he's like, fuck it, it's 2018. Headhunters were cool. Everybody loves Chameleon. I'm getting the guitar out. So it was just, you know, kind of interesting. It's like he's certainly come back to the fold there. Lionel had all sorts of fun doing various guitar heroics. Some of them were just, you know, straight out rock guitar screaming. Some of it was the more African stuff. He would sing into a mic that was like harmonizing his vocals. Herbie did one with a headset mic that was a mellower, harmonized vocal, like some of the stuff for like the mid to late 70s or early 80s. He was funny as hell. He made jokes about his memory. Just a very charismatic guy and super relaxed. And it was, the Hilbert's Theater was pretty full. And I mean, when he came out, people were standing, people were hollering. This was not an entirely, you know, 50 plus crowd. This was not an all Caucasian crowd. People were excited to see him there. It was noisy. It was enthusiastic. So it was cool. I was really happy to see it. I felt like, in a sense, you know, is it my favorite Herbie? Not necessarily. And I kind of like the, because Joyce, like, well, they played 4 30-minute songs. It's like, well, I kind of see what you're saying. I mean, it was kind of the Miles Davis style of you play a tune, you segue into another tune.
Right.
And if you knew his whole career, you kind of got those signposts, but if you were not familiar with him, you just kind of got excited when he finally played Chameleon. And the hilarious thing was, is that if you remember, you know, his music from the 70s often would be pretty extreme in its dynamics. You know, it'd go down to a whisper and then it'd come. Well, anyway, every time it got quiet, people just started clapping. Like, are we done yet? Are we there? Is this the end? It's like, no, there's more. You know, then it start building again, then they stop clapping. Then they get quiet again, they clap some more. You know, it's like, dude, yeah, just give him time, man. He's 78. He doesn't give a fuck. He's going to play 30 minutes. You're just going to have to wait. You know? And I heard some like 20-something saying, oh, it's just amazing. Age is just a number, blah, blah, blah. And I just wanted to punch the little fuckers. But, you know, they had a point.
Well, my most recent Herbie experience was he was in a movie that I just watched, which came out a year or two ago, believe it or not, how weird this is. Yeah. There's a French director who wants to be an American Hollywood director. His name is Luc Besson. And he's made a handful of, he's quirky, he's interesting, but he wants to make Hollywood blockbusters. You know, The Fifth Element is probably the movie most people know. If you have taste, the movie you'll know is Leon the Professional, also known as Natalie Portman's screen debut. Very
disturbing. I know The Fifth Element, just to make it clear. And you know what The Fifth Element is? It's Love, Motherfucker. Okay, anyway, go on.
So anyway, this most recent movie is his attempt to do a kind of, you know, space movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was,
and definitely to be watched if you drop acid. The colors alone will be like a whole second trip for you. It's very inventive in some ways. Its chief flaw is that it's an adventure plot, but the main story is, will the hero and his assistant consummate their love? And the problem is, the female is a wonderful actress with just tons of charisma. And the male lead, I forget his first name, his last name is Dahan, is terrible. He's a horrendous, horrendous actor. Completely charisma-free. So when he does cool stuff, you just keep thinking, God, I hope he dies this time. You know, God, oh, I hope he's dead. No, fuck, you know. And the female, she's just very, very charismatic. And you're like, don't go for him. Don't go for him. Really, don't go for him. So anyway, in this space film, they're like space cops. And that of the space agency is a hologram played by Herbie Hancock.
Awesome.
For reasons that make absolutely no sense. Like, I'm like, how did Luc Besson decide, let's see, we need someone to do a hologram. I know, Herbie Hancock. Like, how does that conversation happen? And Herbie was fine, but that's the last time I've seen Herbie in anything. But it was very weird. Did they just pull random names out of a hat, you know? I mean, how do you decide?
Well, he's got a little, you know, in a very different way. But if you talk about Afrofuturism, you know, you look at the cover of Thrust, and one, you say, why did this great nephew do it? But two, you know, it is that some of that imagery. And of course, you know, Herbie's got an electrical engineering background from Grinnell, of all places. Oh, and he's always been into technology and sound. You know, some of those mid-70s albums were like direct-to-disc, yeah.
I was chalking it up to, you know, French love of things. Of jazz? Like Jerry Lewis, you know? So it's like, you know,
well, Jerry Lewis. That's probably the real expression. But yeah, I mean, he's always, yeah, he is, you know, of that generation, the most technologically oriented.
Yeah, I did not know that. That's interesting.
That's the side of him. So I was just really happy to see the guy, and he's in great shape for 78. But yeah, if you think, you know, what's his concert going to be? I didn't know if it was going to be like a mix. It's like, nope, this is going to be about 1972. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 145. Special thanks to Matt Phillips, who gave us some of the suggestions for these British artists we've been discussing. If you'd like to read some of his thoughts on jazz, go to soundsofsurprise.com. That's plural, soundsofsurprise.com. And he's got a blog there where he talks about various jazz releases that I think you might enjoy. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. You can also reach me on the Facebook page, or if you'd like, contact me at All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from many sources, including our website, www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Mixcloud. You can get it from Stitcher. There are a number of places you can track us down if you'd like. And we do enjoy hearing from you, both at the email and the Facebook page. It's useful. We do listen to your suggestions. Compliments are always nice. Insults are accepted. So do look us up. It's nice to hear back from the people we're trying to reach with this podcast. Tune in next time as we examine A French Connection, where we look at several artists from America who recorded in France, as well as a artist who came from France to record a murderer's row of great jazz musicians on the Columbia label. We'll be looking at work by Michel Legrand, the group Circle, Coleman Hawkins, John Coltrane, and Chet Baker. Till next time, take care.